If we get in advance all of the area reports from the biologists in the Department of Fish and Game. And I've been reviewing all of those, trying to apply them to the proposals that we have in front of us, and trying to make some sense of how it applies and what the problems are. When we go into a meeting, what we do is we'll take a region, in Sitka we have shellfish to deal with, and then we have the troll fisheries for Chinook salmon. And we'll get staff reports on those. Then we enter public testimony, and then when we come back and deliberate on each individual proposal, the staff will give a report on that proposal, whether they support it or don't support it, whether it's allocated and they're neutral. They can tell us what will happen if it passes, that type of information. When you get into controversial allocated decisions, whether it's king crab, whether it's gillnet and set net, a lot of the criteria that you use, the things that you use are the same. I don't have to know exactly what depth is best to catch king crab to make a decision on who gets to do it or when the seasons are going to be, that type of thing. Definitely benefits the more I know, there's no doubt about that. But I can still look at the other information that's given to me, and I think make an objective decision on an allocation question.
One more question. Mr. Houghton, you, getting back to limited entry, what are your feelings, or how do you see the matter of useful entry into our fisheries? I know that in many coastal areas it's the economic livelihood industry, and that's about it. So how do you see the useful entry into a limited entry system?
Useful entry, I'm trying to understand your...
Useful. How do young people get involved in the system when we have a limited entry system? What are your feelings about that?
Well, I think it's difficult. I think that's one of the controversies of the limited entry situation. We hear, for example, in Togiak, that the young people can't afford to buy a permit. You know, a kid's 17 now, 18, he's become an adult. He cannot afford to buy a permit. And so he ends up working in the fishery, either in processing or as a crewman. But in Western Alaska, a lot of Alaska, the local regional residents are having a very difficult time getting into that fishery unless they work for someone else. And that is a complaint that we have heard a fair amount on the board.
Let me continue. So, knowing that about the situation, you know, what do you think should or could be done about it?
I don't know. I haven't given that a lot of thought. I haven't sat and discussed it with people and exchanged ideas and come to any conclusions about that. I can't answer that.
Do you think it's something that should be dealt with? Do you feel that it's a social economic problem that the board should look at, or what are some of your personal gut feelings about it?
I don't see how the board can look at it. The way the structure is, it's just not, powers to do that. My gut feeling on it is, in Western Alaska, a lot of those villages are growing in population. Cash economies are very important, very difficult for them. And you're talking about commercial fisheries where a permit holder, might make $5,000. So cash economies are important. And as those generations develop and some of those populations expand, they're going to they could conceivably lose the little cash economies that they have, which are derived from commercial fishing. What's the answer to it? I don't know. Do you, if you looked at it to make some kind of a concession to allow those folks to get new permits in an already fully utilized fishery, do you take them away from somebody else? Do you change the structure where you don't sell them, you give them, pass them on? I don't know. You know, there's so many variables there, and there's no simple answer to say let's just give these folks a permit, because what you're going to have is a more crowded fishery. It could become to the extent that even you wouldn't even make $5,000. It wouldn't even be worth putting your boat in the water. There'd be too much. So I don't know what the question of that is. It would take a lot of thought and a lot of discussion if there is an answer to it.
Thank you.
Going back to the chum tagging study, did the board make any recommendation to the staff or whoever on continuing that study, or how much more information they need? But like, is it 5 years, 10 years, or did you get into that kind of discussion at all?
No, we actually didn't. The board's kind of, you know, reluctant to ask for things that we don't have funding for, or that the department doesn't have funding for. I think we all acknowledge that 1 year has a lot of variables to it. The timing of when the chums come through. The public testimony said that the Yukon call chums were late, up to 2 weeks late. And that it was the opinion of a lot of the folks up there that they came through after the tagging study. And that on a normal year, they would be present during the tagging study. We just, you know, we would love to have more information. But no, we didn't come to any conclusions that we need at least 3 years to draw, you know, a good database from this, or 5 years or anything else. And we didn't say to the department, to, you know, Mr. Parker, well, let's see if you can go back and get some more studies done here. We didn't do that. We really didn't discuss all that.
Okay, another question would be, putting the fiscal question aside, resource economies, did you make any recommendation on resource economies on the board?
We're going to finalize, the board's going to finalize its comments on that type of thing, the review commission's report, at this meeting in Sitka. In some of the discussions we have had, I would say yes, that's going to be one of our recommendations.
Thank you, Representative Cotton.
You're still an officer with the Professional Sport Fishermen, is that right?
No, I resigned as an officer. I was at that time vice president. When I was appointed to the board, I resigned. I am now just a general member. So I'm no longer an officer.
What about conflicts there? I mean, I'll give you an example. The Cook Inlet red salmon run about the same time as the silver salmon do, and so you've got some mixed stock problems there. But one of the propositions that came up last year was that they put the drift fleet over closer to the mouth of the Kenai River, then there'd be more of a likelihood that the fish, you know, that were headed north for the Susitna and other northern drainages would be able to get by. Plus, the Kenai, the Cook Inlet drifters would like to be able to get close to the mouth of the river. And the people set netting and the sport fishermen up north like that idea too, because the fish would be able to get north. But the people that didn't like it, of course, were the people that with professional sport fishermen on the Kenai River. So if something like that comes up, do you feel like, obviously you have to say, yeah, you'd be objective and so forth, but is there anything in particular you'd do to make sure everybody believed you?
Well, you know, with the conflict of interest, first of all, I could not, would not participate in any discussions formulating proposals for issues like that.
You think you'd have a conflict there, so you'd stay out of that one?
I would stay out of it.
Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah, I would. And what's... I would not attend any meetings where they discuss strategies or putting a proposal together. I mean, sure somebody can call me on the phone and say, look, you're a sport fisherman, you have to understand.
Well, I
don't understand what you're saying. How am I going to stay out of it? What do you mean? Am I going to get a war room over here and sit?
No,
there?
It just seems like it'd be important for you to participate in that decision. I mean, you're kind of viewed as the sport fish rep on the board, and so I mean, whether or not that's official, I mean, I'm sure it isn't. But that's one of the reasons you got appointed was because you had a background in sport fish. So if you're going to stay out of the allocation fights on sport fish and Cook Inlet, what good is that?
I guess what I'm telling you is that the conflict of interest, at least we've been advised by the AG's office, that if I participate in discussions and formulating a proposal, if I participate, this is prior to the meeting, if I participate discussing strategies with a group like ASA or Alaska Professional Sport Fish Association, if I involve myself in any way in those types of things, I have to abstain from deliberations and voting on those proposals. So I guess if I am a sport fish representative on that Board of Fisheries, and if part of my job is to represent them, I sure can't go and do it in that manner, helping them formulate a proposal and going and saying, look, here's what the board's going to want to hear, and you guys have to write this proposal this way.
That's not what I'm talking about. Let me back up and say that, you know, when those kind of decisions become, you know, something you're going to have to vote on a decision like that one of these days, perhaps, or maybe you won't, but I just would encourage you to try to, you know, not be too quick to jump out of the picture there. Certainly you shouldn't be prepping your friends on how to appear in front of the board. That's not what I'm talking about. You know, when those decisions have to be made, I hope that you'll be a participant in those decisions.
I can't jump out of them, because when I vote on that proposal, I'm going to tell the public why.
Yes,
and what I used to do it, what I base my information on, and why. If it's an allocated decision, I'm going to say why we're taking it from that group and giving it to this group. And they're going to know why. So I can't jump out of it. I have to be there.
All right. I just wanted to make sure I understood that. Finally, just to, if you were to be arrested for violating a regulation on fishing and were to be convicted, what would you do as far as your position on the board is concerned?
I think I'd resign.
You think you would? You might not, huh? If you were convicted of a fishing violation, you might resign. Is that the answer to your question?
If I was convicted of a fishing violation, if I was on the river and an officer stopped me and I did not have my sport fish license on my person, was in my wallet, which is in that airplane 100 yards down the beach, and I got ticketed for it, I would have to think about that one.
But what the law says you have to have on your person, right?
The law says you have to have a sport fish license on your person. So if my wallet was in that airplane, basically I could be ticketed.
So what should you do? I mean, we've all faced that, so I guess we ought to get a little plastic bag and put it in our pocket, is that right?
You know, I've given all of that a lot of thought, and not only am I responsible, but now really, because of my position on the board, I have to be particularly sensitive to everything from my assistant guides who guide sport fishermen for me. Even if they were to be cited on something, the public perception would reflect back on me, even though it wasn't me personally. So I have to be particularly sensitive to all of those type of things now, basically, that I'm representing the public. And I've given that a lot of thought, and yeah, I'm going to have my fishing license with me.
I'm not sure if anybody ever asked me that question. Thank you.
Any further questions? I know you have to catch your plane. Thank you very much. At this time, we'll go to Fairbanks to Arthur Clark. Do you want to give us some brief remarks, and then we'll see if there's any questions?
My name is Arthur Clark. I'm a lifelong resident of Fairbanks, Alaska. I'm currently working with Northern Appraisers, a real estate appraisal company in Fairbanks. I've been invited as a public member to the guide board, and I've attended two meetings. I came to the board with no preconceived notions, but just as an interested member of the public. That's about all the comments I have.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions? Representative Springer.
I think you're aware of the controversy brewing over the outfitter guiding business. Can you give us a short idea how you feel about that, the way it is handled in Alaska right now?
Well, actually, the outfitters and guide issue, it seems to me to be a rehash of an old problem. In 1974, I understand the original purpose for setting up the guide board was to handle excessive pressure in small areas by all the guides congregating in areas where the game was. And so now we have the outfitters coming in and doing the very same thing. I'm not sure exactly what the solution is, but I would like to have seen or see some action taken by the legislature this session to handle that, but I don't think that that's going to happen.
I don't know if it's going to happen or not, but I sure like to get some idea what you think how that outfitter problem is going to get solved, since you're going to sit on the guide board. Do you think they should be regulated, prohibited, shot, gassed, or whatever?
Well, I'm not certain they should be shot, but I do think that they should, some form of regulation is in order. I'm not just exactly sure how that's going to be accomplished. Right now, we don't have any jurisdiction over the outfitters. We do over the guides, and we try to maintain their numbers in reasonable numbers to handle the game that's in the area. And so I suspect that the outfitters will probably at some point come under us if, in fact, any regulation is enacted. And I don't know what to do about that bigger problem at this time.
Okay, thank you.
Any further questions? Representative
Cotton. Yeah, Mr. Clark, I'm looking at your resume here and see that you were assistant manager for Kodiak Oilfield Haulers between August of 85 and August of 86. Are you familiar with the some of the problems that Kodiak Oilfield Haulers had on the North Slope?
No, sir, I'm not. I worked as an assistant manager at the terminal in Fairbanks and did not get up to Prudhoe Bay.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Representative Springer.
Yeah, I got one follow-up on the marine mammal guiding business. You know, the governor decided here not too long ago that the state is not going to pursue further the management of the three marine mammal species. But prior to that, there was some pretty unique language drawn up in regards to who is going to do the guiding for polar bear and walrus. Are you familiar with that?
We haven't had any dealings with it, and I am not familiar with that topic.
Okay, how do you feel about, basically in a nutshell, the regulations were geared to allow guiding only by people that have resided 10 years or more in the adjacent community. How do you feel about that?
Can you please repeat the question? I'm not sure I understood it.
Okay. The regulations that was drawn up in regards to the guiding of polar bear and walrus, if the state would take over the management of those species, one of the prerequisites to be allowed to guide for those two species was that you had to be a 10-year resident of the town adjacent to the hunting areas for those two species. How do you feel about that?
Well, as a practical matter, I think that that's kind of appropriate, but as a constitutional matter, I don't think that would be legal. In a practical sense, knowing what you're doing out on the ice would be very important, especially if you're guiding people that have never been there before. But from what I understand about the constitutionality of it, it's not.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, we're going to leave the lawyers out of that. I understand what you're saying. Thank you.
Any further questions? Hearing none, thank you, Mr. Clark. Samantha Castle in Fairbanks, could you please come forward and give some brief remarks?
Yes, this is Samantha Castle. I am from Fairbanks, and I've been in Alaska since 1959. in 1963 and 64, 65, 66, attended the University of Alaska. Went on to purchase a lodge, Wood River Lodge, in the interior with my husband. Worked as a guide during the period up until 1983. During that period, I hunted and guided and maintained camps in Wood River in the interior, Kodiak for brown bear, McCord for muskox, Savunga for walrus, and Point Hope for dog team polar bear. I had an opportunity to travel worldwide and examine game management systems, and I'm very impressed with the system that we have in Alaska. I think the process we have is very good and fair, and feel that over the last 5 years that I have not been working in this in this particular industry, I have been working at the computer center in Fairbanks, Alaska, and I feel that that I'm coming to the board of game with a very objective point of view. I don't believe that I have any particular kinds of labels, and feel that I am able to represent a very fair and objective stance.
Any questions of Samantha? Representative Springer.
Yeah, I have a couple questions. One of them, just in a nutshell, from a policy standpoint, how do you feel about controlling a predator-prey relationship situation? And I'm not trying to put you on the spot, but let's just use the wolf-moose situation in the interior.
Well, thank you for asking that question. I don't feel put on the spot by it at all. In fact, over the last 5 years with the enactment of ANILCA and some of these other things, we had serious allocation considerations. I feel that in the interior in particular, we have some sort of declines in both the interior and South Central, I should say. There is no clear idea in my mind at the moment whether it is a predator-prey relationship or in fact whether there are other factors such as disease, habitat, poaching, or just what exactly the problems are. In fact, there are herd declines in some of these areas. It is affecting the subsistence allocation and consequently the resident or the general hunting and the non-resident allocations. And the Board of Game in the last meeting has instructed the Division of Game to do a study of, in particular, the Mancaster herd to try to determine whether there is a wolf-bear predation problem, whether they're taking a disproportionate share of the resources, or whether there are other factors such as disease and poaching. In other words, just to study the issue. And I feel that that this is not, or I should say, I hope that this is not an issue, but rather a problem that we can all approach in a very fair and objective manner.
Okay, that's what I figured you was going to say. But unfortunately, it has always become a political issue. When you have a clear defined problem, let's just use an example, say the dusky coos at the Copper River, and coyote or foxes as an identified predator, what is your stand of preferring one species over another in a case like that?
You have to go back to the management objective for the game management unit. And I have been working since I've been put back on the board, which of course is a very short period of time, to reinforce the idea that we need to have an overall game management plan for these game management units. And if it's determined that a particular area has a need for increasing the moose population because of the subsistence shooters in the area, and it is determined that there is a predator, a wolf, coyote, or whatever it may be, that is taking a disproportionate share of that resource, then I do believe that it's important to put in place some sort of predator control. But again, it has to start with an overall game management plan.
Yeah, and who would formulate that plan?
That plan would be formulated between, with the information of the Division of Game, working in conjunction with the Board of Game. That is not something that I feel the Division of Game should be able to do themselves.
Where does that leave then the special interest groups that have so successfully formulated our management goals, let's say greenies and groups like that?
Well, they have every opportunity to try to secure a position on the Board of Game, and they have every opportunity to contact Board of Game members and have public testimony and to write letters to the governor and to user.
Okay, thank you. Couple short ones, easy ones. What do you think about shooting females in the population of mammals? Like cow moose?
I'm not going to give you any general answers on that either, because those are very specific problems. If in fact it's determined that there is an overpopulation of the species in a certain game management unit, and it's determined that it's a good game management tool to reduce that population because of serious habitat problems, then I have no problem with shooting cow moose, for example, if that's what you're dealing with. Most of these questions that are asked of me and probably of you are very general questions that you can't give specific answers to and shouldn't give specific answers to, because the resource as a whole is damaged with that sort of a generalized approach to management.
The reason I asked that question was specifically, you know, in the interior, from time to time we had problems where the game managers said that the bull cow ratio was bad. We opened cow seasons, and then the old sourdoughs come out of the woodworks and say, "You just don't shoot mama," and we closed it down again and had the corresponding damage done. And I'm glad to hear what you're saying. How do you feel about baiting black bears?
I'm opposed to reducing the opportunity for those people who do this activity in a legal manner. What we have discovered over the last year, and all the proposals that you may have seen for the Board of Game to consider this time, were because of the illegal use and the abuse of that activity. The Board of Game took testimony for almost 3 weeks. It was something that came up in both statewide and specific regional areas. And there was a compromise situation developed. It does severely restrict, especially in the interior, the activity of bear baiting. It did not eliminate the opportunity for those people who wish to do it in a legal manner. I think that I will probably see additional proposals in the next call for proposals, which will be 2 years, to modify the stand that the board took on this. And I encourage that to happen. But in the next 2 years, I also expect those people who abuse the activity in the first place to clean up their act.
Well, thank you. And one last question in regards to sea mammal hunting, specifically trophy hunting of walrus and polar bear. What would your personal desires be on that?
My personal desires are based on the wonderful experiences that I had in Savunga prior to the closure of sea mammals. I wish that the state could get this activity back. I have taken a look. I've gone through the process over the last couple of months of determining how the funds are available for managing. I think that the Alaska funding situation at the moment for the fishing game is very severe. I would be very concerned that priority would be given to sea otters and walrus, for example, instead of some of the interior herds. And though I'm very reluctant in saying this, I'm probably at this point in time feel that the governor made a correct choice in not accepting or encouraging management to come back to the state. I do hope that this will be reconsidered at a future time, but priorities with money at the moment simply would not allow good management of those species.
Okay, thank you very much. I like your answers a lot.
Are there further questions? Hearing none, thanks. I'd like to thank everyone that's been online today. And now I think we'll go off teleconference. We had a request from the public to testify. We didn't get to that today. We'll try to get to that at a later date. At this time, I'll turn the chair over to Representative Cotton for Dude Creek, and also 492 will be held over.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd move that the House Resources Committee adopt HCS for Senate Bill 362 Resources, an act establishing the Dude Creek critical habitat area, providing an effective date. The subcommittee of Representative Gall and my staff and the people that were here from Gus Davis and the department have arrived at a bill everybody appears to agree on. We passed this out yesterday, so I sent a question. I'm sure I can answer it. Otherwise, is there objection to the motion? So then I move that we pass the bill to committee. Is there any objection to that? Thank you. Please sign the report. Yeah. In order, please. Today is April 14th. The House Resources Committee members present are Representative Springer, Hoffman, Sund, and DeVar. We have two items on the calendar today, but the first thing we're going to do is spend the next 15 or 20 minutes listening to Dr. Henry Cole and his guests today from the National Coastal Resources Research and Development Institute, NCRI. And I'd ask Mr. Cole to join us and perhaps introduce this group at this time.
Thank you. Appreciate very much, Mr. Chairman, being able to appear before your committee. This is the National Coastal Resources Development National Coastal Resources Research and Development Institute, which is a federally funded program, basically, which is interested in economic development in coastal regions of the United States. I will leave the detailed description of the workings of it to the Executive Director, Tom McGinnis, who is behind me. But members are Don Morton, Michael McCollum for California, David Lohman, Oregon, Marshall Landolt from Washington, Director of Fisheries, and William Wick from Washington, and Dr. Weber, who's Director of the Hatfield Marine Science Center from Oregon. And the reason that they're here is that I persuaded them that this might be a good time to come up to the state. Usually we meet in a variety of locations depending on the members' homes. And one of the other reasons that I felt it was important at this time is that this is a working research funding outfit, and it would give some credibility and some sense of substance and some sense of what the procedures are to the kind of legislation that we're looking at right now in terms of research in the state of Alaska. I think this is a very good group. It's been a real pleasure to work with you. So, Tom, with that.
I'd also announce for the record that Representative Schultz is with us. Just for your information, I'll just go around the table here and let everybody just say where they're from so you'll know who you're talking to here. I'm Sam Cotton. I live in Eagle River, which is part of Anchorage, if you're not familiar with that part of the state.
I'm Henry Springer from Nome, out of the Seward Peninsula.
I'm Dick Schultz. I'm from Intasta.
Chicken.
Interior.
Intasta.
No.
Yeah.
What's the coastal region here?
Yeah, right.
The Yukon River.
Yukon River, supposedly. Yeah. About 180 miles from there.
And this is Cliff Davidson, who represents Kodiak.
Thank you. And I'm Lyman Hoffman from out in the Bering Sea, out of Bethel.
I'm John Sund. I'm from Ketchikan, which is the southern southeast portion of the state.
I'm Mike Navar from the Kenyak Peninsula, which is south central peninsula right there in the middle of Mass.
Good. I'm Tom McGinnis.
Welcome.
Thank you. And I'd also like to introduce Mike McCollum, who is the Deputy Secretary for Resources for the State of California, and the chairman of my board. It's a pleasure to be here this morning, and I want to pass these around briefly. I'm just going to walk through them, but I thought you might be easier if you had something in your hand, something you used for file filler. And there's a practical reason to hang on to something like that, because as you have constituents call you and they say, well, I have an idea, I'd like to get a new industry started, or I have an idea that would improve the economy of our coastal town or region or whatever. It's hard to know where to send them sometimes. And this is the purpose of NCRI, which was created in 1984, is, or as I see it, is to promote over the long term diversification of coastal economies. The sense was, by Senator Packwood, who wrote the original legislation, that you look at most non-metropolitan coastal regions, you find a boom and bust economy, primarily because they have a narrow base of economies, many of whom are resource-based and interrelated, so that when factors such as the cost of the dollar or interest rates or whatever affects one, it tends to affect the entire group at the same time. In Oregon, where Senator Packwood is from, we had a depressed coastal region for quite a number of years, despite the fact that in the Willamette Valley, where we have our largest cities, the economy was rising and falling, but the coastal economy was staying low. It just wasn't participating with the rest of the state. So the senator decided that the only thing he could do with the amount of money he had available to him was to develop a means of affecting long-term change by creating what amounts to a think tank, really. That's how I like to term it, although it is action-oriented. So he created NCRI. His advisors on the Commerce Committee told him that this was a problem that wasn't unique to Oregon by any means. So NCRI was created to be a national institute. We have projects in states ranging from Maine to Florida to California to Alaska. We have, in order to promote diversification and environmentally compatible resource development, we will support projects of a research nature or a demonstration project. The first time some approach is taken, we would be willing to underwrite it. We have underwritten a few things that are we think emerging into profit-making businesses now, and in a project like that we put in a fairly liberal, I would say, repayment provision, where if the project is profitable over a period of years, we'd like to get our original investment back, and if it isn't, well, these are research funds, they're not loan funds. So we are looking at high-risk opportunities, but with potentially high gain, that can be replicated other places in a region. Our five criteria are that a project should promote economic activity, that it should be coastally oriented. These are on page 2 of that handout. That it be highly applied, and that is put in there to discourage basic research projects. My personal opinion is that basic research is essential to the future of the country, but there are a lot of organizations supporting that, and that is not in our legislation, so we don't. Also, that the result will be available, whatever the result is, and of course that would depend on the project that was funded. I mean, that's part of what's in the project. What will your result be? So it's understood that there will be some real-world action take place at the end of whatever study or project we approve, and that it should be available within 3 to 5 years from the day we sign the first check. And finally, that it should be regionally and nationally applicable. And I would add, in the case of Alaska, that the consensus of the board seems to be that Alaska is a region in and of itself because of its many unique situations. just to give you a brief understanding of the kinds of things we've been getting, if you turn to page 4, there's a bar chart that shows it shows what proposals we received, or the percentages of proposals we received
in the fall of 86, but I could show you a similar bar chart for practically any solicitation period, and it would not look significantly different. We've tended to get a bulk of aquaculture projects, and of course, since those are the bulk of the ones we receive, they tend to, the percentages of the ones we approve tend to bear that weight, that weighted distribution out. But also, as you can see in all sorts of other areas, tourism, port policy and planning, ports and harbors, fisheries, seafood technology, marine resources, forest resources, that is coastal forests, ship construction, interbasin transfer is specifically, or primarily, a Great Lakes problem. So those are the kinds of proposals we've been receiving. We have a few things going in Alaska. One, the most recent one that is funded through a second program that we manage called the Coastal Zone Interstate Management Grant Program, is one to use remote sensing techniques to determine likely oyster aquaculture sites. The idea being you can save yourself a tremendous amount of time and money if you know what the parameters are for the ideal oyster aquaculture site. A lot of those parameters can be derived from satellite and remote sensing inputs. So what you do is you lay out a map and you start stacking different remote sensing inputs one on top of another, and through the process of elimination, you get down to a manageable number of sites that then you would that would be hospitable, apparently hospitable to oyster aquaculture. And when you get that subgroup of sites, that manageable number, then you send somebody out and you go look at it. But this just eliminates a lot of money flying and driving around trying to determine what's appropriate and what isn't. That's about all I would say at the moment. We do have two ways of putting out a proposal. We will have one solicitation a year where we just say we are NCRI, here are our goals, here are our criteria, we have some money, send us your ideas. And that solicitation goes out in June. And it's a fairly plodding process. June through August, we look at pre-proposals, and then August or September through December, we look at full proposals, and then these are all sent out for peer review, and the granting is made in May. The ease of this, as opposed to some other programs, and the charm of it, I think, is that a pre-proposal, which is the first thing we ask someone to send us, is two sides of a page. Basically, we send the person who has an idea a single sheet of paper with five questions on it. And we ask them to answer those questions. And what we're trying to get at is, why is this important? What do you plan to do? How do you plan to do it? And what will it cost? And that's all the questions you get on the first pre-proposal stage. Then we will get on the phone or through an exchange of letters or whatever, we'll determine whether that's appropriate and whether the person wants to go forward. And if they do, then we have about an 8-page form for a full proposal. And that basically asks you to fill in those, answer those five questions in a little more detail. We can grant to any individual or organization, and we watch the money. If you send it, if a university receives a proposal, we tend to take a more arm's length approach than if an individual who's never done this sort of thing before does that. And
what does that mean? You take an arm's length approach?
Universities have a contracting office. You generally work through a contracting officer, and basically you send them checks and they monitor the project. Because universities have a whole structure for managing this kind of thing. But if we're not working through a university, we will tend to have a distinct set of deliverable either progress reports or something, some deliverable that a person must submit to us before we will fund the next stage of the project, and one of us may actually come out on site and look at what's going on, just to be sure that a person who's never done this sort of thing before is tracking what he or she said they would do. So it's fairly easy to get through the paperwork. It's not extensive. The other thing is, while we have this process that lasts for a year nearly, if a person has an idea and there's a situation where time is of the essence, you want to strike while the iron is hot, we have the ability, and we do, we'll do the whole thing out of sequence. And we've turned a proposal around in as little as 8 weeks. So we can do that. Starting this year also, we'll be developing with Henry and other members of the Board of Governors and Advisory Council and people around the country that we have gotten to know, requests for proposals for specific problems where, rather than just wait for things to come in the door, we've determined that there is a problem or an opportunity that might be addressed, and we'll write a request for proposals and send that out to anyone who would like to submit. So we like to think we're flexible. We don't have a lot of money. The top of our bell curve of projects is about $50,000. We funded one for as little as $3,000 and as much as $165,000.
Is this budget sheet on the second page, is that reflective of the entire budget, or is this the operating budget, or is this the applied research budget?
It's a small amount of money. It's $1.25 million a year.
That includes your operating expenses?
Yes. But our operating expenses are very low. I have 4 people. And then the board serves for free, and the advisory council serves for free. So we have quite a batch of free labor.
I'm sure everybody at the table here is mind spinning trying to think of a project that we've been in the district about right now.
I've got 4 or 5
I'm sure Mr. Chapman's already got it figured out. It looks like nobody else has a burning question there, Mr. Sun. Mr. Sun, then Mr. Davidson, you did have his hand up.
Well, I just want to say I really appreciate knowing about this group and thank Henry for bringing you up to Alaska. But I'd like to get a little feel for the range of projects that you're looking at a couple of examples to... one of the bigger problems I think we have in the coastal communities on the boom and bust has to do with actual methodology of managing the fisheries itself. And the example is the halibut fishery. Those of you who are in resources know that we fish all our halibut in Alaska in about 24 hours. And doesn't seem to benefit anybody, but we seem to be trapped into some kind of mode that doesn't let us get out of that. And we have other management strategies. The committee here is familiar with my story on the rockfish in southeast Alaska, which we started 5 years ago, which are just about fished out, that we've been unable for either political reasons or biological reasons, whether to grasp a theory of how to manage these fisheries, either how to limit the entry, how to gather the resource data and knowledge of how long those fish are there, or how to do it, whatever it is. We're doing the classic Western methodology, fish them hard till they're gone and then close them down. And we seem to be encroaching more and more into more specific fisheries like gooey ducks, sea urchins, sea kelp, and abalone, and more of these fisheries we've ignored in the past, and we seem to be just applying our old fish them till they're gone methodology. And I just wondered if any of your funding or that is looking towards trying to come up with management schemes that would just better spread out the catch or minimize the boom and bust on existing stocks.
Just for the record, I'd like to note the presence of Representative Pierce, who is also from Anchorage.
All right. We have one proposal in from the state of Alaska right now to look at the groundfish but other than that, we haven't done anything on management of fisheries. We haven't received, we have received one or two that were not approved for one reason or another. But there's, when we were originally created, because we were just getting started and there was a lot of ferment in that arena, we were asked to avoid by our congressional patron, we were asked to avoid that issue. I think that's something that the situation has changed markedly since 1984, which is when that request was made.
Chairman, just I have two more questions. We're just trying to get a scope. There's another project of one of the problems we have in Prince William Sound is in the black cod fishery, but particularly tracking a large amount of killer whales. And fishermen are authorized under the Marine Mammal Protection Act to use lethal action to get rid of them. Really, the only people in the United States that are allowed to kill marine mammals. And a recent trip that I sit on with the Pacific Fishery Legislative Task Force was in San Diego, and we went out to the SeaWorld there, which has a nonprofit arm. And one of their theories is that the hauling of the gear, the back hauling of the gear, actually generates the sounds in the water that ring the dinner bell, so to speak, for these killer whales. And they were looking for, their proposal was to go aboard the boats this year with very, very sophisticated listening devices, record all the sounds from the hydraulics to the pulleys and everything on the gear, take it back, try to break up all of these sounds and match it up with their hundreds of hours of tapes they have on killer whale sounds and see if there's any match that there is. And if there is, then either electronically or mechanically try to mask that on the boats in order to keep killer whales from coming into the gear and therefore cut down on the mortality and avoid this whole issue in Congress. And they were looking for some money somewhere, whatever. I mean, is this a project that they could apply to you about?
Yes, they could apply. There's nothing on the face of it that says to me that it wouldn't be something we could consider. By the way, just in that regard, though, I would mention that you may be already aware of this, but the new NOAA administrator is the former director of the SeaWorld's nonprofit foundation, the Hubs Foundation, and the world's expert on marine mammal acoustics. So,
yeah, we met with him.
Yeah, so you have a strong advocate at the head of NOAA for attempting to use acoustics to avoid having to kill the whales.
Okay. Just one more question on soft dollars, just to see, are you into market development at all? One of the issues that we approach a lot of the small firms in Alaska, trying to develop secondary products of Alaska fisheries, run into the problem of no market or market development, or how do you, those are real soft dollars to put $50,000 to go out into the world to see whether you can develop a market for fisheries or products. There may or may not be a return. Most of the time there isn't. Is that something that...
Yeah, that's as something that we could consider that's appropriate. We've had one. Let me start by saying we have funded in the past about 20% of what we receive, primarily because we receive 20 times what we could afford.
40 after coming to Alaska.
But we did receive one from Alaska that we did not fund, that was right along those lines. And the main reason it wasn't funded was that this fellow had already built this market. He was really looking for someone to help him build a factory, and tended not to fund bricks and mortar.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question concerns the CZ-309 program. You didn't elaborate much on that, but I'm an alternate member of the committee on the Western Legislative Conference, and we recently released a report on the ocean resources policy as regards to activities in the EEZ, or the exclusive economic zone. I was wondering if you funded any projects to date in Fort States, or individuals who are looking for some solutions or answers to some of the questions of that EEZ.
That's a nerve. that you've just touched, because Jan Mills is our representative on that board. We sent in an application. The Coastal Zone 309 program is done just a little bit differently. For the Coastal Zone program, we put together, or the states put together, with us acting as their agent, a roster of specific projects that they want to undertake. And then they send that as an application to NOAA's Office of Coastal Resources Management, which then funds those projects or doesn't. And the top of our priority list this year was a joint project by Biliana Cisensain, Mark Hirschman, and Dick Hildreth on just that question. And we had, I think, 8 projects. That came in at $60,000. $70,000, and they chose not to fund that one and to fund all the ones below it. And so we've been involved in some discussions with them subsequent to that about the need for this out here and why wouldn't they fund it. All I can say is I think the tide is turning on that. I think if we submit it maybe next year, we'll probably get it. Primarily because I think there's going to be a change of personnel in the office that will make the office more accommodating to the state's interests in the agency.
The other question in the research that you sponsor, is it available to other people, or is it on the property of the people who've done it, or how would you, for example, if this were to be funded next year? And this is an area where Alaska, I think, is lagging behind. In fact, this is my pitch to this committee to do something in the interim on the ocean resources management policy, because I know California, Oregon, and Washington have all passed legislation dealing with what their states can do to work in concert with the federal government as new policies and regulations come down to manage that zone. So, is this information available from projects that you would fund out of the 309 to other states? Or?
Yes. And in addition, by the way, the deputy assistant director of NCRI, Earl Buckley, who's not with us this morning, but he's here in town, is on the SB 630 task force, which is SB 630 is Oregon's offshore resources bill. And so if you want more information on that sometime during the week, I can get you on the phone with Earl. He can tell you what they're specifically doing with that bill in terms of the regulations and policies and the information they're planning to generate and that sort of thing.
I have that bill in my office.
I think I have a copy.
I hope we're not. Did you have a meeting at 9 o'clock you're hoping to get to?
We as a group will be meeting for the next 3 days. And since they're all here, nothing's going on.
Well, we have time for a couple more questions. Senator Fisher isn't here yet. His bill's the one that's up next. So, Mr. Springer?
Yeah, I see that about roughly 20% of the proposals are in the agriculture field. And you know that's in Alaska a pretty hot item, both politically and also from a scientific standpoint. Are any of those proposals in the field of finfish mariculture?
We have one on striped bass. We've been trying to generate a good one on red drum. We've done a number of things on salmon. And as a matter of fact, Brian Lee was on the advisory council for the salmon. It was called the Salmon Aquaculture Investment Guide for Public and Private Users. So, yes.
Have any of those proposals been out of Alaska?
Well, as I said, the one with Brian Lee was done, Alaska was involved in it. I'm trying to think if there were, does anybody remember any other finfish proposals from Alaska that have been funded? No, I don't think so. We've gotten 2 on salmon.
Well, especially salmon is a real hot item here. And, of course, the committee gets covered with information from both sides with pros and cons, and one of the surprising things to me is the allegation that there's just such a big vacuum and lack of scientific information in regards to it that I would think if that is a fact, there would be innumerable proposals for research, because some of them are in very narrow niches. So it surprises me that isn't the case.
Thank you.
Well, it depends, if I could make a comment, it depends on, of course, what people in an individual area feel is important. And if there is controversy about it, people might avoid getting into it. What is interesting about this group is that whether the proposals are funded or not, I find it most interesting because it defines the areas that people are interested in moving ahead in a given small community. And maybe the proposal goes down because they don't prove out on certain aspects of the economic argument or whatever. But it's a much more organic way of looking at some of the needs instead of a bureaucracy coming in and saying, well, we feel that you need this or you need that, or we're going to develop this area for this particular reason. So if people come forward, I mean, this group is in a sense a feed-through. It matches up the money with the ideas, and if the ideas do not come from outside, then it won't happen.
While we're all here, I wonder if any of my board interested had any questions either, because one of the reasons they came to Juneau was to learn, and you folks are tremendous resources.
I'm sure that the committee members would field questions if there were any. Sure.
I'd like to ask, reemphasize something from the questions on the type of projects that you're referring to. And by the way, for the record, I'm Mike McCollum, the chairman of the group until Sunday, I guess. one thing that we try to differentiate in our project that we fund is the differentiation between C grant projects and our projects. And a lot of the questions we had, I think, concern probably C grant more than us. It's not to say that we don't fund or try to fund fisheries related projects or aquaculture projects, but we're looking for a much quicker turnaround in results. And also, we have some of the projects that you brought up are major, major projects that are going to take millions of dollars and years to accomplish. We're primarily limited, and we'll only have about $1 million a year to disperse in grants funds. And we like to spread that across the United States, so you can see it can get kind of thin on projects. So we like to try to leverage it, make sure that we're putting in some money, and a bunch of other money come in from other sources, and to target toward projects that are going to have a quick result, so that within a year or two or three, we can have some sort of result that demonstrates that it did have some economic benefit to the coastal region. Some of the projects that you're mentioning, I think, have a lot of merit, but I think you have to look for more long-term and more quantity of dollars to get anything accomplished with it. So just to sort of reemphasize that, because if we get a whole set of applications for major projects, you're going to be disappointed because most of them will be turned down because they're just beyond the scope of our particular resource.
Go ahead.
Well, I just like to comment this. You remind me a little bit about an experiment the state undertook a few years ago called the Renewable Resource Corporation, where we tried to put money into what we call a venture capital fund, where the state would invest venture capital into profit-oriented operations throughout the state. We just didn't limit it to coastal communities, but when we went into a boat building, aluminum boat building outfit at Togiak, this is a picture of Togiak, there is a herring fishery out there, figured that people on the beach could learn how to build their own boats to fish there. That would be an economic activity. It would help mellow out their boom and bust. They could do it during the winter, and that type of project, and it would be a return on the dollar or something like that. We tried it. We ran into a lot of political problems, and the concept crashed and burned. But anyway, I think maybe if you get it one step out of politics, it might work a little bit better.
Yes, sir.
Chairman, I'm Bill Wick from Oregon. I'm director of the Sea Grant College. It's been mentioned a few times here, in the same position that Ron Dearborn served. just want to make sure that you remain aware that the Pacific Group of Sea Grant Institutions has developed the system to work together on programs that are of mutual interest. And this gives us an opportunity. None of us have all the talent we need. It gives us a chance to focus talent from a number of different institutions. This actually sprang from a series of meetings, some of which were held here in Alaska in 1970 and 1971, trying to identify what are regional problems. A lot of easy ones have been solved, as Representative Sund indicated. There's some really tough questions left, doing multi-species fisheries, for example. But this resource exists, and we're always open to trying to put together.
And they have that. They do have more money in their hand toward more basic research.
Is there a list available of the 98 people that applied last year and those that were successful? And mm-hmm. Is that something that I didn't see it in this packet? Is that something we could get?
Yes.
It might help us think about how we might encourage our own constituents to understand that this program's available and that maybe generate some ideas. Okay. Hiring is what we call it around.
Pardon?
We call it pirating.
I could provide that to you. And in addition, of course, Henry walks away with not only the list, but he's been calling some of those folks who haven't been successful and attempting to mold their proposals so that they will be the next time around. I guess one of the things I should emphasize is that our goal is to solve problems, not fund research. And so, if something comes in and it's a little bit off the mark, we don't just send it back and say sorry. We send it back with comments about why it was off the mark and what might be done to make it more acceptable, and attempt to, if there's a glint of promise there, we attempt to cultivate a future proposal that will be acceptable. It's something we've not done as much as I'd like to because of our schedule, but we've, during this, after this solicitation, we've changed our schedule so that we will have more time to do just that.
Yeah, I'd just like to offer, I know you're congressionally federally funded, that we do have the Pacific Fishery Legislative Task Force meeting in the first part of June in Ketchikan, and one of the things that we have tried to do as a task force is not only meet with all the Sea Grant people, we meet up and down the coast four times a year, but to support not only their funding on the federal level, but something in your area too. And if you could all provide me with some type of resolution and where to direct it, I would be willing to bring it up in front of the task force and see if we can't get their support. And the attempt there is to galvanize, you know, all of the congressional support on the West Coast behind certain types of the efforts we're trying to impact on the federal level.
I appreciate that.
Throw that. Bill Bradbury is from Oregon's honor. Dan Hauser from California is the chairman this year.
As a matter of fact, while I didn't even think about a resolution and no one has made that generous offer in the past, I did present our program to the Legislative Task Force when they met in Olympia a year ago.
Yeah, I missed that.
Representative Herman was there.
Washington has joined now. They joined last month, so we've got the whole West Coast wrapped up now.
Well, thank you, Mr. McGinnis, Dr. Cole, Dr. McCullum. Appreciate your taking the time out of your schedule to help us understand the Institute, its goals, and how Alaska might better be able to participate.
This group will be in town for another 2 days. Today and tomorrow, and actually Saturday, and like numbers might be attending the legislative skit night in order to more deeply understand the government in Juneau. There is one other announcement I'd like to make, and that is that there's going to be a science and engineering meeting, commission meeting on fisheries resources, which will have members of John Gisberg, Mary Tutton, Richard Pace from Universal Seafoods in Alaska, talking about the processor's perspective. This is a discussion of Northern Pacific fisheries in a general sense. Collinsworth,
Ole Mathiesen, Brian Lee, and Henry Mitchell with North Pacific Fishery Management Council. This is next Friday. It will go throughout the day. I will have an agenda prepared for it, and there will be there will be plenty of opportunity for legislative comment if people can get down there. I know the time is very, very tight, but it is, I think there'll be some useful discussion going on there, so I will pass that on to you later. That's next Friday.
Thank you, sir. We'll take a short recess here, and we do want to hear both bills today, so go away, don't go far, please. And to pay the state of Alaska compensation for damages for their loss. Very intriguing topic, Senator. Please tell us about it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. The resolution, I think, really tried to give a chronological or at least a sequence of events. The key is when the Russia owed to the United States Alaska, they drew a demarcation line, which is not a boundary line, it's just a demarcation line. And at that time, these islands were not yet discovered. So in essence, they couldn't sell something they didn't know about, and we couldn't buy something we didn't know about. And if you look at the resolution, we tried to set out that actually the lands, at least there's a strong feeling that the lands do belong to the United States through active discovery. The big question, of course, is, you know, what can we do about it? And our Constitution says that the only way you can give land away is through a treaty. There never was a treaty, so from a technical point of view, there's a strong feeling that these lands do belong to us, and we need to reassert our sovereignty over those lands. I think it's quite interesting that the state of California had passed a resolution in support of us getting those lands. The state of Ohio also did the same thing now, which is kind of interesting. And the governor, it's interesting, our governor sent to the Sacramento Capitol a letter thanking them for on behalf of Alaskans for their taking the position they did in our support. And it seems to me that since other states are coming to our aid, we at least should be out in front saying yes. And we're not talking a war, we're not talking gunboats, but I think it should be done properly as our Constitution said it should. So that's basically it. It's an issue that President Reagan and Gorbachev meet. I think something should be discussed at that time to see what we can do. So that's basically it. It's a long title, I agree. But
want to make sure we didn't add anything to it. Do you have any maps, or can you show us on the map where these islands are? Maybe show us that demarcation line.
Well, there's a demarcation line. You can't help. I guess that's what it is.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the islands are up there. They're actually closer to the Soviet Union than they are to us.
Do we have any map that shows them?
There should be a map in here.
What about this map?
I don't know if that would. Oh, I doubt it.
Mr. Chairman, that's not the demarcation line up there.
It's a dayline.
That's a dayline, yeah.
It's a dayline. But I thought I gave you all
the map.
I have my own map here.
Oh, here. Yeah. Or any island, you can see it over there.
All right, here we are.
Okay. I don't know if you can see, but that's kind of hard.
Sir, we can put it up on the wall.
Let's put it right there. This is Alaska.
Well, it should be there.
Okay.
Yeah, I can.
Okay. The word is, or at least the rumors are, that there's rich deposits of oil, they feel now, or gas, in that particular area. So,
got a reason then.
Okay, well, of course, here's the last. These are the islands here. I just circled them. And, you know, they're just a blotch, really, on the map, but that's where they're located. This is the demarcation line. It comes up this way. So they are on that side of the demarcation line, but when we bought Alaska, these were not yet discovered. They were discovered after we bought.
Where is the demarcation line?
Over here. And then it goes.
So we bought on this side of the line.
Well, no, that wasn't the deal. The deal was we bought this.
Right.
And then just the demarcation line was drawn, but had nothing to do with the purchase, saying that everything on this side belongs to the United States and everything on that side belongs to Russia. That's not the case, because they didn't know what was over here. They knew this existed, but they did not know these islands were there. So they were discovered subsequently to buying after we bought Alaska.
So I don't understand why do people think that you have any claim on these.
We discovered them.
Oh, discovered.
Yeah, discovery rights.
Yeah. Now, which, all the way over here? Too?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a little.
There are some Aboriginal people that knew about it before we did.
So it's by discovery that we claim ownership.
Yes.
Chairman, just a question. There's a, and I can't think of the name of it, Senator Fisher, but Senator Ewing has a resolution in Judiciary Committee that he's been asking me to schedule. Is it on the same issue?
No, I think it's somewhat different.
Is it the same issue, though? Or?
No, I don't think that. Okay. No, I think, no, it's not the same, exact same issue as this.
Okay.
No.
What's the, has there been any official response, or have you had any communications with the State Department?
No, I'm sure you've all had correspondence with a group called State Department Watch.
I think it's War, is it War Department, or?
Yeah, they call it, well, no, they call it State Department Watch.
I meant the United States government. Have you had any communication with the U.S. government?
I haven't had any correspondence from the government. Senator McCaskey last year said he was going to look into it, but they're still not. It's a iffy situation, I guess. Senator Helms, though, in U.S. Congress, and a couple other congressmen have introduced legislation there also to do the same thing we're trying to do on a national level. It's a technical situation, if our Constitution means anything or if it doesn't. If it does mean something, then it should be done by treaty. I was looking at the New American, this is a March issue, but there is a paragraph in there that people say that, you know, if Wrangell, and this is just quoting, but it says, if Wrangell was never claimed by the United States, then why did the 3 years of negotiations culminate in the transfer ceremony held in Bethel, Alaska in April 14, 1975, in which the United States gave the Soviet Union formal use of Wrangell Island? You know, so in other words, it is a problem out there, and I think we need to address it. Now, maybe the U.S. by treaty would say, yes, you may have it. Then that's one thing, but it still takes a treaty to do it. So they're still up for grabs in a sense of if we have rights of discovery mean anything. It's not going to create international war or anything, but...
No, it's an interesting subject. I've had a hard time here. I've told you this. I've had kind of a hard time taking this seriously because I didn't really feel that they would necessarily be part of the state of Alaska, or that really our action might really be meaningful, or you know might result in any action on the part of the United States government, certainly as far as compensation to Alaska or otherwise. But I wouldn't mind. And you haven't made any effort to contact the
State Department. Won't give you any.
They won't respond.
Well, no. And if they do, see, if they come out and say we gave it away, then they're in trouble. If they say no, we didn't, then they're. I mean, that's a catch 22. Are going.
Have you requested them to show up here?
No, I haven't requested them.
Is there anybody? Is there a State Department office in Juneau?
I wouldn't think so. In Seattle, I would suspect.
I can go check the phone. Why don't we make an official inquiry from the committee on this to the closest State Department bureaucrat?
Okay.
See what kind of response we get. Let's do that today. Because I mean, I don't want to completely ignore it, but at the same time,
this is probably the most important piece of legislation that's going to come out of this legislature this year.
Well, Mr. Springer?
I have a question.
Some of us would hope there's others.
Yeah, it's sort of scary.
I have a question on page 4, line 12. We refer to Rainy Island has been reported that Rainy Island has been the last known place of imprisonment of Wallenberg and who saved thousands of Jews from the Nazi Holocaust. What has that got to do with the bread and butter issue?
That's probably the bread that that's probably the marmalade that you're going to put on the bread. What we tried to do, though, in all seriousness, we tried to tie in as much of the primary resources that we could also, whether it be, when we have reports, for example, one of the primary pieces that we did use was a 1881 report. And you could argue that, yeah, that why should we do that? I mean, I don't have any objection to you supporting me to take that out. We tried to give as much a chronological basis as we could.
Well, I'm fairly familiar with Spring Island. I've done a lot of research on the avifauna of that thing. And all of Siberia was a forced labor camp anywhere from 1941 to probably in the early 80s. And Wrangel Island had only for a very short period some detainees. As a matter of fact, Wrangel Island has a very special status in the resource management structure of the USSR, as it is declared with some of the areas of the Chukchi Peninsula off limits to any development because it's a scientific research area. And as a matter of fact, 90% of the snow geese, which are in winter in the United States, originate from there. It's also a big polar bear tending area. And so that has really, really very limited utilization right now. And I don't see where that, those both paragraphs, especially under the light, if we want to perpetuate some goodwill in renegotiating, I think that's just counterproductive, both articles. That, and believe me, I'm not very sympathetic to the Soviet government, but that if I see what the crux of this thing is, that we want to reopen it up, that we want to get into negotiations, I think both paragraphs from line 9 through 16 are somewhat counterproductive to the aim of this resolution. Okay. I'm not making a motion to take it out, no, just an observation.
But I don't think there's another referral on this, is there?
It's for the State Affairs.
Oh, it goes to State Affairs after here?
Yes,
sir. Is that correct? It doesn't go, I see. So
no, it's got a way to go.
No, it's got no further referrals.
Oh, this is it?
This is it.
Yeah. We do things differently on the House side, Senator.
No, you don't either. I don't want to. No, just in passing... the two measures that started out with 9, there's 8 to go. 8 referrals to go.
Yeah, well, are there other questions? Does anyone else here want to testify on this measure today? Well, we're going to, since this is the last committee, I would like to get some sort of official response from the United States State Department on this to see what they will say. So we'll make an official
report. I would suggest, Mr. Chairman, I know time is running out, but if you get no response, maybe you want to put a deadline as to when you should get a response from them, because you may end up getting none, which is a response, but it's an indirect.
Well, we'll make every effort, and if it's a no response, we'll try to get an official, an official no comment out of them. I mean, This sounds like that might be an interesting exercise in itself.
No, you could send letters to, I'll just pick a name out, Senator Jesse Helms. I'm sure he'd get it in 3 days.
Right,
probably.
I appreciate the mainstream nature of Mr. Helms' politics. And Mr. Navarre?
I was wondering if we would consider perhaps getting a perspective from the General Secretary. Maybe we could get him on telecom.
Well, the United Nations, he's in Geneva today signing the Afghan pullout of the Soviet
Union. Since you've shown the most interest in this, we'll assign this to you and the subcommittee. Thank you, sir.
Okay, thank you.
Do you, do you mind if we keep your map for a little bit while we return it?
No, that's okay. I don't think we've paid for it. So.
All right, we'll make sure we understand. It's your property. John, did you want to testify on behalf of Senator Fanning for the next bill in front of us, Senate Bill 397?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, I'm John Mayland. I'm an agent of Senator Fanning, and he asked me to make a few comments for him on Senate Bill 397, which this may seem like an old friend to you. Many of you have seen it before.
It's a little acquaintance.
Acquaintance, okay. You have his, I believe in your packet, his sponsor statement, but I'll go through it just real quickly for the record. Senate Bill 397 is designed to prevent intentional harassment or obstruction of persons engaged in lawful hunting, fishing, or trapping in Alaska. It was passed by the legislature in its form in 1984 and in an earlier version in 1983. Both times it was vetoed by then-Governor Bill Sheffield, who explained his actions by saying no real need existed because few incidents of hunter harassment had taken place, and that in his view, current criminal statutes covered the issue. The bill is patterned after legislation adopted by the states and has similar penalty provisions. It also provides a liberal defense clause to protect those who mistakenly believe it was not unlawful to disturb hunting, fishing, and trapping activities. As the legislative body of the state of Alaska, we have a responsibility to protect Alaskan citizens, as well as those who visit from outside in their pursuit of outdoor recreation. This bill does this and reduces the potential for violence in the field by providing judicial relief for those aggrieved by intentional harassment. If you have any